From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. First, Avatar conquered the box office, and on Thursday it makes a play for your living room on DVD and Blu-ray. But the release will be in regular 2D, not 3D. You'll have to wait until the holidays for the extra dimension. Ever since the film arrived in theaters, there's been a race to bring 3D technology to screens big and small. And as NPR's Art Silverman reports, stereoscopic viewing is no longer a guilty pleasure only for the secular world.
I went to an exhibition of 3D TV here in Washington, D.C., and I was impressed watching perspiring men shoot hoops, climbers descend into the Grand Canyon, and 3D fish swim about.
It makes you feel like you're truly in the ocean.
That's fellow gawker Darren Dedre of Tyson's Corner, Virginia. So, if 3D technology can take us under the water, could it let us see someone special walk on the water?
Welcome to 3DCatholicTV.com. We're glad you stopped by.
Catholic TV out of Boston has gone 3D.
I'm Father Reed, and these are my 3D glasses.
So far, so good. But here's the trouble. There's no storytelling. Catholic TV's website is mostly travelogue. Walks through St. Peter's Square or tours of the Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. I expect 3D to give me some spectacular vision.
I would show the transformations of the body of Christ.
That's Professor Angela Zito. She's the co-director of the Center for Religion and Media at New York University. While Zito wishes the Catholic video outlet was generating more vivid content, she's not at all surprised that the church has embraced 3D.
Printing was actually invented by Chinese Buddhists in order to produce sutras.
What excites Zito about the potential of 3D for religion is that the technology allows us to see the unseeable.
Our imaginations don't work in a vacuum. They actually require a kind of vehicle or something to inspire them. And I don't think that this is going to limit our imaginations. I think it's going to concretize more seductively the things that we can imagine.
Once Catholic TV lets us use our imaginations more, it will have greater impact on viewers. Catholic TV's father, Robert Reed, says that at this point, 3D TV is still just a gimmick for them.
Considering the fact that our faith has so many dimensions, it just seemed sensible to me to look at 3D and to see what we could do with it right now and how we could use it in the future.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining me to pray the glorious mysteries of the Holy Rosary of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Today, we are standing here in Piazza San Pietro.
For now, Catholic TV has the future to itself. No other religion has 3D plans. Not the Mormons, not the Baptists, not the Muslims, not the Hindus. Even the Jews are still operating in 2D.
In the past, 3D came and went. I am very skeptical.
That's Rabbi Mark Golub, president and executive producer of Shalom TV.
We are still, you know, sort of, we're horse and buggy here. The Jewish community has focused all of its attention in the past on print and the print media. We are the people of the book.
And Rabbi Golub has no envy about being beaten to 3D by a Catholic TV outlet.
The Catholics have always beat the Jews.
So for now, Catholic TV has the field all to itself, hoping that if they can capture the eyeballs of viewers, the hearts and souls will follow. Art Silverman, NPR News.
Charlie Sheen is the highest-paid actor on television and the star of the highest-rated sitcom, Two and a Half Men. But now he's in contract negotiations, and he's indicated he's ready to leave the show if he doesn't get even more money. And that leaves some wondering, could the series continue without him? Commentator Andrew Wallenstein says, no problem.
Sorry, Charlie. Two and a Half Men could have a future without you, unthinkable as it might sound. If you make good on your threat to go, well, we'll miss your sardonic wit.
Uncle Charlie does not like to start his day with a squealing creature in his face.
If Sheen thinks he has CBS over a barrel, he should brush up on his TV history. It's been proven time and time again that a sitcom can go on even when the main attraction takes off. In fact, one of the best examples of this trend involves Sheen himself. When Michael J. Fox was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, he was forced to give up the lead role on the ABC comedy Spin City.
By 11 o'clock, the city's going to smell like a giant foot.
But ABC replaced Fox with a new character played by Charlie Sheen. The ratings actually went up.
Good morning, everyone!
Comedy's been proving their durability as far back as 1969. Remember the sitcom Bewitched? Dick York vacated the role of the husband after 5 years, but Dick Sargent assumed his character for another 3. And who could forget years later when Shelley Long shocked Hollywood by dropping out of Cheers? She was forgotten pretty quickly once Kirstie Alley came in.
Do you have the time?
4:30.
Good. Because I just wanted to remember the exact moment I met the biggest jerk on earth.
Now you could argue, would Cheers have survived if Ted Danson walked away? Or if Elizabeth Montgomery left Bewitched? You know what? I'd still say yes. Because one of the hallmarks of a great comedy is the way humor is distributed throughout the cast. It's a little surprising when you think about it. Comedy is such a delicate chemistry. But the same can't be said for dramas, which almost seem to thrive on these cast defections. Just think of how Law & Order has swapped out actors on an almost annual basis. Now, I'm not suggesting every comedy ever was immune to cast changes. Seinfeld might have seemed to be missing something if it lacked, you know, Seinfeld.
Not that there's anything wrong with that!
My bet is the writers and producers of Two and a Half Men are engaged in a pretty interesting creative exercise right about now. They might be wondering, what brand name actor could they bring in? And what kind of character could he play? I'd say it could be a she as well. But the show is called Two and a Half Men.
Andrew Wellenstein is an editor at The Hollywood Reporter.
This is NPR.
Seattle is saying goodbye to its favorite purveyor of what is euphemistically called adult entertainment. The Lusty Lady Peep Show says it's closing its doors in June. And as NPR's Martin Costi reports, the announcement has triggered a rather surprising outpouring of nostalgia and regret.
I'll cut to the chase. What people really like about the Lusty Lady is the marquee. Every couple of weeks, there's a new message up there, and it's usually a pun, a body pun. Stuff like Squeezin's Greetings and Happy Nude Year. And let's not forget Erin Go Bra-less. Most of the puns are groaners, but Seattleites seem to like them.
It's such a landmark.
Tracy Timmons is the librarian at the very highbrow Seattle Art Museum right across the street.
I'm also a bus rider, so I wait at the bus stop in front of the museum, and I'm often interested to see what their marquees are going to say.
For instance, when the museum showed the work of a certain Dutch painter, the Lusty Lady's message was, "Go all night." For a whole generation of Seattle kids, that marquee has been the highlight of school trips downtown. Charles Armstrong was one of those kids.
I think I was 12 or 13, and we took a field trip to the art museum, and the pun at the time was, it was at the time The Lion King was out, and the marquee read, "The Loin King." I thought that was hilarious.
So hilarious, in fact, that Armstrong and a friend now run a website that tracks the Lusty Lady's ever-changing marquee. Of course, very few of the marquee's fans ever actually go inside.
I'm Martin Costi, I work for NPR. Oh, sorry, you don't have to take your gloves off.
Janitor Bob Lambert snaps off his latex gloves to shake my hand.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
And he gives me a little tour.
Basically, what you do is you go in, you pick a booth that you want, you go in, you put a quarter in, and then this shutter will rise up and there'll be 4 women behind glass dancing. And then the shutter will go up and...
All right, gentlemen, our private pleasure group, we have the very sexy hot female.
A quarter buys you 30 seconds, and as the marquee once said, all clothing is 100% off. This kind of live porn used to be a mainstay in ports and disreputable carnivals, but it's disappearing fast, another victim of the internet. Pauline Hant says she just doesn't get it.
It's not the same. That's what I keep trying to tell people. These are live ladies right there.
Hant works the front desk. She says she used to run around backstage when she was just 3 years old, when her mother was a dancer. The Lusty Lady gets a lot of goodwill in Seattle because of an urban myth that the business is unionized and owned by the dancers. That's actually a different Lusty Lady in San Francisco. Still, Pauline Hance says the Seattle version is a good place to work. To her, closing the Lusty Lady is like tearing down the Space Needle, and she blames the yuppies.
In the 80s, this was the dive part of town. We had tattoo parlors and gay bars and strip clubs and peep shows. Anything an adult wants to do, you could do it here. And now it's the Four Seasons, and we have fancy chocolates on the corner, and it's not what it used to be.
And that seems to be the real appeal of the Lusty Lady. In a neighborhood of matte steel condos and coffee shops with accents in the name, that dirty pink marquee sticks out like a welcome sore thumb. And now that the end is near, some of the people who like the marquee are actually peeking inside.
This is actually the first time I've ever been in my 5 years living here, but I'm going to miss the marquee just seeing this downtown.
These two guys, who for some reason don't want to give their names, have joined the procession of mourners to the doors of the Lusty Lady. They walk in a jokey mood, but they come out again pretty darn fast.
You want to wash your hands as soon as you leave.
The fact of the matter is, the Lusty Lady is sort of like a pun. It's funny, as long as you don't think about it too much. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tippi Hedren is probably still best known for being pecked nearly to death by 100 inexplicably angry birds in Alfred Hitchcock's 1963 classic, The Birds, but she kept her fur coat on and barely a hair out of place. Although best known as Hitchcock's imperturbable cool blonde, Tippi Hedren's appeared in many other films and TV series over the years and produced others. This year she received a Lifetime Achievement Award, but not for acting. The honor comes from the Genesis Awards, the Humane Society's Oscar Ceremony for Animal Rights, for her work on behalf of lions, tigers, and other large felines at the Shambhala Preserve that she founded in 1983. Tippi Hedren joins us now from Acton, California. Ms. Hedren, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So who do you have out there at Shambhala?
We have lion, tiger, liger, which is the father is a lion and the mother is a tiger. Black and spotted leopard, mountain lion, Asian leopard cats. We've got a tremendous number of the exotic feline.
How do they wind up there? I think a lot of people might remember when Michael Jackson's two Bengal tigers were
yes,
were
Thriller,
there.
Thriller and Sabu. You know, none of these animals are good pets, and they will eventually get to the point where the people who have them will get to the point where they can't deal with them any longer.
So what fascinates you so much about large cats?
The thing that's so fascinating about this is that these are apex predators. These are the animals that are the reason why you don't see old animals in the wild, you don't see sick animals in the wild, you don't see lame animals in the wild, and it's all because of the predator, the lion, the tiger, the leopard, all the cats.
Can we go from cats to birds for a moment?
Oh, sure. I have to tell you something funny.
Sure.
Because, you know, we serve about 500 pounds of meat every day. We have this huge flock of raven who live on the preserve because they're meat eaters. And they know the whole pattern of when the animals are fed. And I want to tell you, we have the healthiest flock of raven you have ever seen, and they're big and shiny.
Now, I read, I think in some Hitchcock biography, that at least a few of those birds in that horrifying scene where you and Rod Taylor are being assaulted, that at least a few of those birds were real.
Do you remember the scene where I go up to that room and open the door and all the ravens and seagulls attack me?
Oh, of course. I think about it every 3 or 4 days.
Of course you do, every time you see one.
Yeah.
You know, when I first read the script, I said, Mr. Hitchcock, how would we be doing this scene where I walk up the stairs and go into that room? And he said, oh, we're going to use the mechanical birds. Uh-huh. The morning we were to start that scene, the assistant director came in, Jim Brown. He couldn't look at me. He looked at the floor, he looked at the walls, he looked at the ceiling. I said, "What's the matter with you?" And he said, "The mechanical birds don't work. We have to use real ones." And out the doors he sailed. And they had no intention of using mechanical birds. They had a chain link fence built around the door in which I enter. And there were about three or four cartons of raven and seagull and a few pigeons thrown in, and which they hurled at me for 5 days.
They're coming! They're coming!
You know, I've often thought that this is the reason Alfred Hitchcock chose an unknown to do this movie, because no actress in her right mind would have done this.
You must have complicated thoughts about Alfred Hitchcock.
I do.
And didn't he kind of put a throttle on your career at one point, too?
Yes, he did. He was a very controlling man. Mm-hmm. I finally just became absolutely to the point where I had to get out of the contract, and I told him I wanted to do that. And he said, "Well, you can't. You have your daughter to raise. Your parents are getting older." And I said, "Well, you know something? Nobody who loves me would want me to be in a situation where I'm not happy. I do want to get out." And he said, "Well, I'll ruin your career." And he did. Kept me under contract, paying me my $600 a week. Years later, I would find out about a picture that a director wanted me for, or a producer, or whatever. And the one that really hurt the most was the French producer, François Truffaut. Wanted me for a film, and all Hitch said was, "She's not available." That was that.
So when Alfred Hitchcock is acclaimed as a genius, is that?
Yes, this is where I have such dichotomous feelings, is because I admired him so much about the capabilities of his filmmaking, and you know what he went through to write. He was very, very much involved with the writers of his screenplays. But he was so well prepared that by the time we started filming the first day, he felt it was over, because it was in his mind, it was finished. Mm-hmm. And he very often knew so well how he was going to edit that we almost shot an edited film. The only time that I saw him unnerved.
Yeah.
Was in the scene where the little finches come down the fireplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ooh.
And fly around the room.
Yes.
Well, they came down the fireplace, and they sat on the hearth, and they sat on the arm of a chair. They sat on the coffee table. And Hitch was speechless. So he had a drummer come in, and the drummer was beating the drums, and it got louder and louder and louder, and we just walked around the room ducking from birds that weren't there. and once the film was edited, it went over to Disney and they drew the birds in.
Oh my gosh. I got to take
amazing?
Another look at that scene. Yeah. Has Shambhala and your care for animals become your principal activity?
Very much so, except I do have to work, because when I founded the Rohr Foundation, I never took a salary of any kind. About 14 years ago, I donated all of the land to the Rohr Foundation so the animals will always be safe. So I do have to work, you know, and I find as many movies and TV shows that I can, because I otherwise I wouldn't have an income.
Ms. Hedren, very nice to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much.
The 24th Annual Genesis Awards airs this weekend on the Animal Planet Network. Tippi Hedren received the Genesis Lifetime Achievement Award from the Humane Society. She spoke... Hey, I think one's on my shoulder now. Spoke to us from her home in Acton, California. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.